That's another radio. All right, stop. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome again to another edition of Liberty Unbridled. I'm your host, Ken Molman, and I had a strong suspicion that the audio was going to be messed up again. There's kind of a telltale sign in the pre-production here when trying to listen to music prior to the show beginning, get kind of in the mood, get my brain ready to go for the show. There's nothing more frustrating than when the countdown lady, and there's a voice that comes on and tells you how many minutes till you go live. The countdown lady comes on and says, here's how much time you have left, and I've stopped your music. Congratulations. So it's kind of a telltale sign. It's going to be one of those nights, but we're going to press through. We've got plenty to talk about, and so we should probably get right to it. Now, if you'd like to talk about any of the topics scheduled for tonight, you can call us here at area code 858-683-1326. Again, 858-683-1326. And if you'd like to talk and not just listen, you've got to press the number one once you get through so that, in theory, Blog Talk Radio will put you into the queue and is someone who wants to talk and not just listen. The chat room is now open. It was not open before. Typically, I do not look at the chat room, but I usually open it up a little bit earlier so people that jump on can get in there and talk or do whatever. And I'll usually check it during the break at the bottom of the hour. But that's, you know, a huge distraction in the show. So I apologize. If I had a producer, it'd be a little easier. But that's all right. We are at a new location this week. Don't know if we're going to stay at this location. The previous location was a good friend of mine who I've known for many years now. He has moved, and so we no longer have a home for the show. So we'll see how this goes, and if we move around a little bit or have some weird problems or whatever, I apologize in advance. But we'll get things stabilized here, and hopefully Blog Talk will get their side stabilized, and we'll continue still, no matter what, bringing you the issues that matter to you on Liberty in Kentucky. So, to get started, this is something that just interests me. It's not really a Liberty thing, per se, but there's technology that they're working on to be able to implant microchips into the brain to help with things like dementia. So, a lot of interesting brain science. A couple of good friends of mine are real big into brain science. I have to say I'm also interested in it. I'm always genuinely interested in how people tick, and that's a pretty big reason. It's all brain chemistry. And so the idea of being able to use microchips to replace or to repair broken parts of the brain, which is what causes dementia over time, is very interesting. It's a very interesting technology. It's very intriguing. I will admit freely that my greatest fear in life is getting old and losing my mind, and that would be absolutely horrible. Despite what some people say, I've already lost it. In all seriousness, I think that's a fate worse than death, to not know who you are, where you are, what you are, and in a constant state of confusion would be a brutal way to experience the final years of your life. So I guess the point is it's very interesting to me, interesting technology. We're still years off from it, of course. But, of course, that's just something of interest to me, and so I thought maybe it would be of interest to you. So getting to politics here, we have hemp. Hemp has been on this show, I don't know how many times now. We've talked about hemp a number of times. And I spoke earlier today with Katie from the Industrial Hemp Museum. She's been our contact here on the show for hemp-related issues. And she was traveling today, couldn't be on the show, which is fine. But she gave me the information that I needed to pass along to you. So earlier this week, Mitch McConnell tried to get an amendment that basically has the same wording as the Industrial Hemp Legalization Bill put onto another bill as an amendment. So that's what he tried to do. And that failed at that time. There's also now been talk of attaching the contents of the Industrial Hemp Farming Bill to the Farm Bill, which the last time the Farm Bill did not pass. The Farm Bill was typically filled with a whole lot of pork projects, And that's one of the reasons why there's a bit of a pause for concern. There's a number of folks who are like, I don't know if that's exactly what we want to do. But that is a possibility. And it could still be, you know, passed as a standalone bill. It's still out there. It's still hanging out and not really doing a whole lot, but it's there. My understanding is it's stuck in committee, and so be it. I don't really know. On the House side, I know where it's at, but on the Senate side, I don't. But the folks over at VoteHemp.org, VoteHemp, all one word, .org, they have put out a blast asking people to call Washington, D.C., to call their senators to encourage them to support hemp legislation, to support hemp and hemp legislation. Now, in particular, they're asking for it to be attached to the Farm Bill and to support it as an amendment to the Farm Bill. I personally would suggest that you should call and say they should support it no matter where it shows up. If they want to tack it on to whatever, if it's something that's going to pass or not pass, they should support industrial hemp no matter what it's attached to. And if, you know, it gets attached to a terrible farm bill, if a terrible farm bill is going to go through anyway, well, then we'll take that. You know, if it's not going to go, okay, well, we can still put it on there. And if it doesn't go, fine, we'll attach it to something else. And so we should be encouraging our senators and our congressmen to put the industrial hemp bill, if they won't give it an up or down vote in its raw form, we need to be supporting them, putting it into something else as a rider on something else. And that's, you know, I don't necessarily like that that's the process, but that is the process. And so we just need our senators right now to support hemp. And if you would call D.C. tomorrow, Monday, the 20th of May, and ask them to support hemp, there's a very good possibility that this will come up this week. My understanding is that folks who live in Michigan and Vermont especially need to make calls this week to ask their senators to support hemp. So that's the hemp update. We also have an Obamacare update. I spoke with David Adams yesterday. David Adams has been on this show several times. He is a Tea Party activist. He's been around. He was the guy who managed Rand Paul's campaign during the primary in 2010. Boy, time goes by fast. And he is the one that absolutely has the been following Obamacare and how it's being implemented probably the closest. He's my usual contact for that sort of information. And, you know, for those that don't know, the Obamacare stuff, it's going to be a train wreck, folks. And I really believe it was done that way on purpose. I don't think Obama was lying when he said we have to go this way first and then we can get to single payer. I really think this thing is built to collapse. There's absolutely no way that it survives. And there's going to be a lot of ugliness in the meantime. A good friend of mine has had his hours cut. Another friend of mine has been laid off as a result of the Obamacare implementation already. And the reason for that is the so-called look-back period, which was created by the Department of Health and Human Services for calculating how many man-hours are being worked are total in your workplace for the purposes of calculating whether or not you're exempt or where you fall in Obamacare. And originally that was just going to take effect when the bill took effect later this year, or actually January 1st of next year. And everybody just said, that's fine, we'll just lay off a bunch of people right before Christmas or right at Christmas. Right after Christmas, we'll just lay everybody off. So DHHS, in typical bureaucratic insanity, said, well, we'll solve that problem. We'll create a look-back period. We'll look back 6 months to see if you're just trying to skirt around this. So in response, the business community said, okay, and has now started doing these said layoffs and hour cutbacks now. And so that's what you're going to see. I have a strong suspicion the economy is going to be bad. We're going to see a jump in unemployment and underemployment from now through July 1st, which is the beginning of the look-back period. And like I said, I can just tell you from a personal anecdote perspective, I have two friends that have been directly affected already that I know of. I mean, there could be more. I have no idea. But here in Kentucky, David Adams has filed a lawsuit. Actually, I believe he's filed a pair of lawsuits on how Obamacare is being implemented. And essentially, he is challenging the law in Kentucky that Beshear has used to expand Medicaid and to fund Obamacare. And so those lawsuits are going. Now, my understanding is the very first hearing on one of these is happening on Monday, and I'm going to try to find this very quickly here, the date, but I know that it's happening in Frankfort, in Franklin County. It is at, I believe, 9 o'clock in the morning, I think. Let's see here. It is at Judge Shepherd's courtroom, Monday, May 20th at 9 a.m. at the temporary, I guess, Franklin County Courthouse at 669 Chamberlain Avenue in Frankfort, 669 Chamberlain Avenue. So you can look that up, and if you want to go and just watch the proceedings, you can certainly do that. And again, very interesting to see how this has played out. You know, there was no enabling legislation to allow the expansion of Medicare and Medicaid and setting up the exchanges. Unfortunately, our state law basically gives the governor unlimited power. Well, it doesn't give the governor. It gives one of the executive branch bureaucracies unlimited power to basically go out and get as many federal dollars as they can get. And it's kind of a weird situation. I don't know all of the full details on that, and we'll have to wait for David to really explain that. But he had a conflict this evening, and he could not be here. So, unfortunately, all I'm doing tonight is I'm able to pass along to you that this is moving forward. There is a lawsuit, and the first hearing is tomorrow at 9 a.m. in Franklin County. So that's Frankfort area. So if you're interested, go on down there. Let's see here. Other things, of course, this IRS thing has been blown up. I mean, big time, right? And I assume everybody by now has heard about this, but just to be sure, the IRS was questioning a number of organizations that had filed to become 501c3s and 501c4s that were related to Tea Parties and Patriot Groups and the Glenn Beck 912 people. And I knew about this, boy, it's been over a year ago. I can't even remember when I first heard about it. This may have started, now that I think about it, back in 2011. This may have started while I was still running for office. It's been a while. It's been going on a long time. And at the time, I told the groups that had come to me, and what do we do about this, or, you know, look at this, or whatever. You know, my basic answer to them was sue them. Because some of the questions they ask are just ridiculous. Now, certainly the IRS has the ability to ask questions, you know, hey, are you sure you want to be an educational institution? Are you going to engage in any political activity? Blah, blah, blah. You know, that those are actually good questions and ones that specifically could protect those groups from inadvertently filing accidentally, for instance, as a 501c3 rather than a 501c4, right? Because C4s can engage in some nonpartisan political activity, some. But these were not the questions. I mean, they were asking things like, hey, we need a list of everyone who's ever spoken at a Tea Party meeting and their political affiliation. Now, those of you who have never been to a Tea Party meeting, folks, that'd be impossible. The Tea Party basically, especially in its early phases, was basically people would get up, get 5 minutes to speak, they'd speak and sit down. And nobody really knew who anybody was. And some people have come and gone, and nobody took notes. These were not ever official meetings. It was never that organized. It was never that type of meeting. So, you know, try to track that down. Good luck. Then they wanted copies of every person that had ever emailed anybody anywhere involved in the group. They wanted, I mean, it's just a ridiculous number of things that the IRS wanted. And, you know, the reality is that, yes, the 501c groups are being abused, absolutely being abused. But the abuse has been happening for years and years and years. We've had liberal think tanks and moderate think tanks strongly abusing the 501c3 to 4 relationship. And in fact, there is a way to funnel money from a C3, which is tax deductible. So anything you give to a C3, tax deductible, right? You can write that off your taxes as the donor. C3s can funnel money up to C4s. C4s can funnel money, which C4s are still non-for-profit, but you usually can't, you can never write off donations to a C4 on your taxes. And I believe the percentage is 80% non-political, 20% political on a C4. So C3s can funnel up their tax deductible money, certain percentage of it, and I forget what it is, up to a C4, and then a C4 can funnel money up from there to a 527. A 527 is a political organization. So political parties are organized under 527, as are political action committees, PACs. And so what you see oftentimes is a 501c3 funnels money up to a C4, which funnels money up to a 527. And it's a way to make it so that you can donate money tax-free and tax-deductible, rather, to a 527 indirectly. And I've been upset about this for a while. Part of the smoking ban movement does exactly that. They funnel money from a C3 to a C4 to a 527, and then they lobby for legislation, basically using money that was donated for educational purposes only, that was forbidden from being used for education. And I think the real balking that comes out of this isn't so much that all these groups filed. It's that the IRS, well, first of all, I think the IRS was lazy. I really think they were like, whoa, who in the world and who are all these people? And boy, we want to slow this down because we don't want to process all this paperwork. And I think that was part of it. But what we're seeing really is just kind of right-leaning groups catching up with the left-leaning groups that have been doing this for years. And that's what we're really seeing here. And that's why, 20 years ago, the right used to scream bloody murder about this stuff. They'd scream about the unions and these different organizations that were funneling money and pushing interest ads and issue ads in areas in contentious races and swinging the outcome of elections. And they used to howl like mad over it. And now you'll notice that even Mitch McConnell's like, whatever. They've gotten over it. And the Citizens United stuff, originally the Republicans howled like mad that the Citizens United passed, that or happened rather, didn't pass, it happened, repealing all those campaign finance laws. And then a few months later they went, never mind, we're not so mad about that anymore. Well, why? Why are they not mad about that anymore? It's because they've learned. They have the same thing that the Democrats now had, which is they have the ability to, they are now abusing the system in the same way that the traditional left has done. That's really what's coming down to, is the abuse is now happening on both sides. And so they have no complaint. And in fact, I have an interesting article here that talks about what's most interesting is it was specifically the Tea Parties and some of these grassroots organizations that were targeted. That what's probably most interesting is that things like the Koch brothers, right, they weren't targeted. Carl Rove, his Crossroads GPS, was not targeted. Pro-Obama groups like Organizing for America and Priorities USA, they weren't targeted. Not the big guys. They were going specifically after the grassroots organizations. And I think that's on purpose. There's nothing more that the political elite fear than the public rising up and turning out and turning over in a peaceful way this government. That we run all the people that are in D.C. out. That we start over with new people that are really committed and are really good people, aren't owned by a corporation or corporations, that are there for the right reasons, not because of ego, not because of a seeking of power, but because they're there to help. Oh, my gosh. I mean, look at what the Republican and Democrat establishments did at their respective conventions last year. where there was obviously an outcome to a vote on the floor of their conventions that the chair ruled in the opposite direction because it had been scripted on the teleprompter the opposite way. And they just they ran roughshod over it. Roughshod, right over these folks. And it's funny because somehow in doing all that, the political establishment, which is very good at manipulating people, has caused people to focus on, now on the right, they focus on the fact that they say, well, they were booing God. They weren't booing God. They were booing being overridden when it was very obvious what the floor vote was. I mean, you could tell. So when you have a vote at a convention of that size, you do it by voice vote, you do it by volume, and if there's any discrepancy, someone calls for division, and then there's supposed to be a one-by-one head count off. And in the case of the Republican Party, they didn't boo per se. They were screaming, call for division. And unfortunately, some other folks there were sort of chanting over top of them, which was horrible. You're overriding the orders of parliamentary procedure, and you're basically causing your own demise. You might win the short term, but you're going to lose the long term politically. But I'm off target here. The point is, you cannot, the bureaucracy, the political elite, the political class, the last thing they want is for you or I to actually make a difference, for you or I to be able to influence and to succeed in the political realm. And they will do anything, to keep that from happening. We'll get on that in a moment, or later in the show. But in the meantime, the whole IRS thing, and this is where we're going with this, we're talking about, the outgoing IRS chief, and this is absolutely hilarious. Somebody asked, about taxes. These guys, they always say, oh, yeah, taxes are voluntary. Oh, really? Really? And I think they say that just to drive libertarians crazy, because we all know that taxes are not voluntary. They are mandatory, and that they are mandatory at the end of a gun. And when libertarians say that, it sounds a bit extreme, but what that means is that try not paying your taxes. See what happens. What are they going to do? You won't pay your taxes. They send you a bill. You don't pay it. They tell you to come to court for it, and whether you come to court or not, you say you're not paying the bill. What are they going to do? They're going to put you in jail. If you resist going to jail for not paying your taxes, because, hey, taxes are voluntary, right? If you resist going to jail, hard enough, they will kill you. They will come with guys with guns, and they will shoot you because you are resisting arrest. And the point is that it is laughable, the notion that taxes are voluntary. Taxes are not voluntary. Taxes are mandatory. And certainly, I guess you have the choice not to make enough money so that you don't owe taxes. But that's kind of a ridiculous thing. That's like saying, well, it's optional to breathe. Well, if you kill yourself, then you don't have to breathe anymore. Well, that's kind of stupid. I mean, that's not – it's a illogical argument. And the idea that taxes are voluntary, well, tell it to Wesley Snipes. Now, I assume everybody, well, may or may not remember, but Wesley Snipes got sent to prison and was made an example of by a judge because he was not paying his taxes. And I have a story here. I didn't know this before. I found it from the beginning of April. Wesley Snipes moved from being incarcerated in a federal prison to house arrest as the second phase of his incarceration. And so tell that to Wesley Snipes that taxes are voluntary. How voluntary was it? Right? I mean, he went to jail. He is still serving time for not paying taxes. Was it really voluntary? No. And that's a ridiculous notion. It's really silly. It's absolutely silly. And speaking of silly, so there's a story here, and I meant to get to this last week, and we did not have time. But there's a guy in Portland, Oregon, who, when he went through security, refused the body scanner. And you know what? I do too. I ain't going through that machine. Man, that ain't right. You're not supposed to be able to see through clothes. You know, that's you're looking through a solid object at me, it's basically an X-ray. And, you know, I know that, I always tell the screeners this too, dude, that ain't healthy, man. You know, being around that radiation, oh, well, it's less radiation than you get in the plane. Well, those guys working, first of all, that's a stupid thing. You know, exposure happens. Of course it does. But is it the same type of radiation? No. People don't see through my clothes when I'm exposed to the sun. And second of all, even if it were the exact same, does that mean I should just go and expose myself to more? Should I put a giant magnifying glass above my head so I get it double or triple? I mean, there's something to be said for time of exposure and risk and all that. And it's an unnecessary risk that in the end doesn't really solve anything. And that's the silly part of it. So I always refuse those screenings, and I always tell those guys, dude, you guys should be wearing lead clothing. I mean, X-ray techs wear lead. They stand behind a lead wall and wear lead. And when you get an X-ray, they cover the rest of the area that's not being X-rayed with lead. There's a reason for that. It's about mitigating the risk of exposure. So this guy goes through a checkpoint. He refuses to be body scanned. And so he gets the pat down. And during the pat down, one of the things they do is they take their gloves off and they wipe it on a sensitive towelette or a sensitive cloth of some sort. I don't know what it is exactly. And they put it in the machine. And I'm keenly familiar with this process because I get it every time I fly. Hooray. Random screening my butt. Anyway, I go through every time and they put it in the machine. And, you know, it sits there and supposedly searches for the presence of any sort of explosives, or if you've been around any sort of explosives. This guy in Portland, Oregon, or in Oregon, he was flying out. He refused to scan. He got the pat down. They put it in, and they said he tested positive for being exposed to nitrates, which, you know, that technically is, well, first of all, it's fertilizer, but the other thing it could be is used for a bomb. So their solution was they were going to, you know, do a more thorough search or whatever. This guy just stripped down naked in the airport, just bare-ass naked. And that's it. He just took his clothes off. And basically, he did so to prove he's not a terrorist. He had nothing on him. He had nothing in him. He had nothing. He was ready to go. There's no reason, whatever. So there was a trial. He got acquitted at the first trial. And the judge found him not guilty because his act was in protest of the strip search, and his, as such, it was protected speech. After the TSA lost that round, they are now using an administrative rule to fine him $1,000 to under the auspices of a rule that forbids passengers to interfere with, assault, threaten, or intimidate the screeners. Well, certainly he did not assault them. He stood there naked and stood there with arms out and everything, you know, just stood there. And I don't really think it was a legitimate physical threat. I don't really see it as intimidation. You know, he didn't egg him on or anything like that. And the only thing you could possibly hit him with is maybe interfere, but wasn't that what they were about to do to him anyway? They were about to strip search him. So, yeah. And because it's administrative court, and this is the stupid thing about administrative courts, there are strict rules about what you can and can't bring into an administrative law. And so his lawyer expects to lose as long as they're stuck in administrative law hell. But as soon as he loses the next round, they will be appealing into federal court. And with any luck, that ruling will be overturned, and TSA will be told they cannot do that. But, you know, who knows if that will happen or not. I mean, whatever. So, anyhow, that's kind of the silliness going on. Another silly thing, a guy ended up jailed and then unemployed for photographing a courthouse in Arizona. Guy was out walking around and just was taking pictures. Now, possibly, you know, there is something to be said. They were taking pictures of him. He was taking pictures of the Capitol at 3 in the morning. Federal Courthouse. Yeah, it was. Federal Courthouse and the State Capitol. 3 in the morning, taking pictures. And they were, you know, asking all kinds of silly questions. If he was part of any extremist group, if, what they asked him what kind of books he checked out of the library. Anyway, all he ended up doing was taking pictures. And they kept trying to harass him about it and whatever. And anybody who knows about the police, whenever they're talking to you, and you can find videos about this, folks, but unless you're being charged with a crime, really, no matter what, don't talk to the police voluntarily. It can only get you in trouble. So the guy kept asking just simply, am I being detained? And when they'd say no, he'd say thank you and move on. And there wasn't anything they could do about it. Until he walked down an alley, and apparently there's some arcane law on the books in Arizona that says that you cannot egress down an alley. Now, it's very obvious that the alley, specifically, the law on that was for vehicles, but he was on foot. Anyway, the short version is he got arrested. They took his camera. And then they also his employer was found out, and he lost his job, and, you know, it's pretty bad. I mean, basically, he was in jail. They took his laptop, his computer, things like that, and, you know, the problem is that they had his laptop, so he couldn't work, so he lost his job. And so the point is he's, you know, not been proven guilty of any crime, but they can certainly make your life very difficult, even without that. We're at the bottom of the hour. I'm going to take a quick break here. I'm going to check the queue because I haven't done that in a little bit. Sorry, folks. It's different working the show from here. But we'll take a quick break here, and when we get back, we'll continue. We have a lot more to cover, and I'm going to have to quit rambling and just get to it. But you are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters radio network. It is Sunday night, and we'll be right back.
Yeah.
All right, folks, we're back. You are listening to Liberty. I'm right on the My View Matters Radio Network. And that song ended faster than I thought it would, so I'm still out on my smoke break. One of the downsides of losing my location is that I cannot smoke and do the show at the same time, which is a true bummer. Anyway, the next thing I had up on the list was a judge has ruled that there is no expectation of privacy while using a cell phone. And we talked about this, I think, a week or 2 weeks ago, about this change and this new application. A cell phone is no different than a landline. Let's be honest. It's a modern version of a landline, right? Everybody gets that. A phone is a phone is a phone to most people. When you talk about common law, when you talk about common sense, a phone is a phone is a phone. But not in legal circles, unfortunately. What the judge has now ruled is that we have two sets of rules. On a landline, in theory, we have now court precedent that says, hey, on a landline, you have to get a warrant. There's a process. But on cell phones, they've now ruled, a federal judge has now ruled, that there is no expectation of privacy on a cellular phone. How? It's so frustrating to me that we have court precedent that protects you and I from abuses from law enforcement. You know, unreasonable search and seizure, right? I mean, tapping cell phones without any need for a warrant, no reasonable expectation of privacy on a cell phone, is an unreasonable search. It is an unreasonable search. And the courts previously found that wiretapping someone's home without a warrant is an unreasonable search. It's not that hard. We've talked about this on the show, I know. It's not that hard to do the right thing, to go out and get a warrant. If you're a federal law enforcement and there is suspicion that somebody is really doing wrongdoing, it's not that difficult to go get a warrant. But it's there as a check and balance. It's there to protect the individual citizen from a rogue policing agency. That's why that's there. Our entire system is built on checks and balances. And all these different factors play in that are supposed to be working together as a check and balance. And part of that is that law enforcement, which is under the executive branch, has to get permission to enforce the laws created by the legislative branch from the judicial branch to infringe on our constitutional rights. And the reason that that's there is there needs to be legislation that says you can do this. There needs to be executive branch that says, yeah, there looks like there's a reason to do this, and a judge to say, yes, there's at least enough here that you have the right to go forward with your investigation on this in this manner. That's a check and balance. Three branches of government all have to sign off. That's good. That protects you and I. But the idea that now they don't need a warrant means that the legislative branch can write laws or not, or they can write very vague laws. The executive branch can interpret them in any way, shape, or form that they so choose and enforce them in any way, shape, or form they so choose. And the only recourse you have after the fact is if you can establish standing in court. And this is an extraordinarily frustrating thing because people have taken this to court saying, you can't do this, you can't monitor us. And the courts have been throwing them out saying, well, you can't prove that you specifically have been monitored without your permission. So therefore, you have no standing to bring this case before the court. But at the same time, the executive branch is under no obligation to inform anyone that they're engaging in these activities. So how do you ever establish standing? How do you ever challenge this in court? It's a nifty little loophole they've built for themselves. How? You can't do it. It's not possible. Because if you can't prove if you can't find a list of who's being monitored, then you can never have that person who's being monitored complain because they don't know. And if you are being monitored, unless you can prove it, you have no standing in court to complain about it. That's crazy. And this nanny state, my God, folks, we're entering an Orwellian era. where the government is monitoring everything. Everything. Now, I heard earlier this week, a rumor anyway, I don't know, I have to substantiate it, but something to the effect of that all cellular phone calls are recorded, archived, and if they ever want to pick them back up, they can. You know, go through them and whatever. Now, I think that's a little bit crazy. You're going to have some serious horsepower to back all that up, and you're going to have some serious horsepower to re-encode that on the fly so it's not a monstrous file. You know, it's going to have to be for those in the technology, you're going to have to resample it at a lower rate. Otherwise, it's going to take up a massive amount of space. But how we have entered the Orwellian monitoring. Big Brother is watching for your safety. Big Brother is watching. And you want to complain about it? Well, you can't. The courts say you don't have standing to complain about it. Oh, you want to run for Congress? Okay. You got a few million dollars laying around? Because that's what it'll take to run for Congress to change it. Oh, congratulations, you won. Well, you're one of 435 guys in the House or one of 100 in the Senate. Now you only have to get 220 of your friends into the House or 49 more or 50 more of your friends into the Senate, and then you might be able to do something about it. But the way things are going, I'll tell you what, that's not as far-fetched as people think anymore. I mean, people are absolutely livid. The government continues to do worse and worse things, and they're not doing what the people want. So as this progresses, it's going to be very interesting, but it's gotten to the point now where the government is even willing to monitor the press. And it was always kind of a joke, right? The press was the fourth branch of government. The press was the group that made sure, they were our eyes and ears on government. They were the ones that made sure that they didn't get out of hand. And now they're going through their phone records. And finally, and in a way, it's deliciously ironic in a way, because they should have been complaining about all this all along, and they haven't been. And, you know, there's ways that the media can be controlled, especially by the executive branch, by threatening to cut them off, threatening to not, you know, allow their reporters to events, things like that, that intimidate the media to make it so they can't speak out fully on this. And now that the cat's out of the bag on things like Benghazi, things like the IRS, it's a floodgate. Now the floodgates are open. I mean, everything's pouring through. Because it's a free-for-all frenzy. They can't cut off the entire media. So finally, that check and balance is starting to play out. But it literally took the executive branch pushing so far as to monitor the press themselves before the press would speak about it. There's also been claims that the U.S. House has a room called, they call the cloak room, which is supposed to be a behind-the-scenes secure location where members of the House can speak to one another without being monitored, where members of the House can talk to reporters off the record, where they can engage in private conversations. There's been rumors that room has been bogged. So has the judiciary, or the executive branch, infringed upon the privacy, the privilege of privacy to discuss things amongst the House? Maybe, don't know. But all this is done under the auspices of protecting you from yourself or from others. And the only way they get away with it is this very vague war on terror, extremely vague war on terror. And the problem with declaring war on a non-entity is that you get to decide how long you're going to fight that non-entity. And we've been fighting the war on drugs for over 40 years. And that war on drugs has led to infringements upon individual rights. Absolutely. All the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court it has. And there's actually special exemptions carved out that, well, you have these rights except in the case of a drug case. Then you don't have those rights anymore. What? That's crazy. But that's the nature of war. War, by definition, unfortunately established by our courts, allows for our rights to be infringed upon, at least some of them. And so there's an article I saw this week that says that the war on terror will last for another decade or two. Really? Another decade or two? Somewhere between 10 and 20 more years in this. I mean, that's an entire generation. It's actually, if you count since the beginning, more than a generation under which we will have lived our lives in an era where our rights have been curbed under the auspices of protecting us. The reality is there is no end to this war on terror, just like there's no end to the war on drugs. It's a war on a concept, not on a real enemy. And just like Vietnam, there's no defined entry point. There's no defined exit point. There's no definition of what's a win. What's a win in the war on terror? What's a win? There is no win. There's no way to define a win in the war on terror. So it perpetuates, and they're able to continue things like the NDAA and Patriot Act and all these things that infringe upon our rights under the auspices of war, a war with no defined goals or exit strategy or end or anything. There's no defined anything. It's just we're just going to war. We're fighting them over there so they don't fight us over here. Okay. What does that mean? What are we fighting them over? I mean, we're dropping bombs on them with drones. Okay. Great. Well, what does that mean? Is there an end to this thing? No, there's no defined end. The end is when the people get sick of it and kick these bums out, the ones that keep pushing this garbage and keep enabling this garbage. It's time. It's time. It's past time to start booting some of these folks from office, not taking drastic or violent measures. Never, ever. I mean, we want to avoid that, folks. That's taking up arms against the government or any opposition like that is the last line. We don't want to be there. We want to avoid being there. And we still have the ability to avoid being there if we do our job now. And that is to start changing who we send to Washington to represent us. People who will stand up, who get to, who understand what liberty is about, what our constitutional rights are about, and are not, to clarify, rights granted to us by our Constitution, but rights specifically protected by our Constitution. We have more rights than what are listed in the Constitution. It's just that the government cannot infringe upon those rights as it was written into the Constitution. That's why it's there. We have to be the ones who do it. Now, I talked about the war on drugs. You know, the attitudes have changed. More and more people have taken the libertarian line, which is, you know what, I don't do it, but I really don't care. It's costly and ineffective to do what we're doing. There was a poll that just came out that shows that only 6% of the population supports jailing someone for possession of a small quantity of marijuana. 6%. And in a way that very much makes sense. I mean, you have to be some kind of just jerk to want to put some kid in prison with a felony on his record, dooming him to a life of welfare or burger flipping over an ounce of pot. I mean, seriously. I've never smoked marijuana, folks, and I've said this on the show, I'll say it again. I've never smoked it. I have no urge to smoke it. This isn't about me or what I want. It's about doing what's right, and it should always be about what's right. 6% of people support jailing people for possession of a small quantity of marijuana. The other 94% do not. And it breaks down, oh, some want to go to diversion, some want to do this, some want to do rehab, some just don't care, whatever. But the point is, what we do today is we jail people. We send them to jail. Despite the fact that 94% of Americans say that's dumb, that they don't support it. Well, folks, it's time to stand up and say we don't support this. We've talked about this on the show as well. government has money, and they have plenty of it, despite the fact that they're running monster deficits. That's their own doing. What we need out of a basic government could be funded. I saw something that said if we went back to 1992 funding levels, we wouldn't need an income tax. The government could fund itself. Now, those of you that are old enough, I remember 1992. I remember the election of 1992. Bush and Clinton and Perot. I remember 1992. 1992 wasn't a bad year, really. I mean, I was just a junior in high school, but it wasn't a bad year. The world wasn't falling apart. There was some debt, but nothing like we have today. You know, things were okay. And maybe that's because I was, you know, 15, 16 years old. I didn't really fully understand what was going on in the world. But, you know, I've been politically aware for a long, long time. I mean, 92, we were arguing over NAFTA. That was like the big issue in 92 was NAFTA. NAFTA, NAFTA, NAFTA. Wouldn't you be happy to go back to 1992? Those of you that are old enough to remember 1992, wouldn't you be happy to go back to a government that ran like it did in 1992, to a world to a government that only involved itself to the effect that it did in 1992? I'm sure there's still things that I'd like to see done even beyond that. I mean, the war on drugs was certainly still going on in 1992. And after the election of 1992, Bush Sr., having lost for his second term, engage our troops in Bosnia and Somalia and some other folks. There are other places that were the inspiration for the movie Black Hawk Down. But before that, 92 wasn't a bad year. There wasn't a whole lot going on here. I mean, we were discussing social issues and the following year was all about Hillary Care. And, you know, it was not a horrible time. We didn't have a bad economy. We didn't have the war on terror. We weren't $1.5 trillion deficit every year, adding on to our debt every year. What we have now is a much larger bureaucracy. We have a much larger control. The state has much more control over our individual decisions. And in order to do that, they have to micromanage us, and that takes people. And it takes, I'll call them what they are, public bureaus, to manage the people. We are being controlled. If you read the book Nudge by Cass Sunstein, it is the handbook of how we are being controlled. Government takes away choices, legitimate choices, things that may be harmful to you or harmful to the majority of folks. They take away those choices and present you with two or three government-approved, that's in quotes, government-approved, choices. And the majority of people don't balk at those choices because what they have found, through psychology and whatnot, that as long as you provide people choices, they don't squeal as much. And that the major mistake that many of these communist and tyrannical governments make is that they say it's my way or the highway, you must do it this one way. But if instead they would say, well, you can do it one of these two or three ways, you know, whatever, we're not bad people. You got plenty of things. Look at these choices, two, three choices here, yeah, you know, no problem. That people don't reject it. And that is the true ugliness of it all. Look at our political system. We have two major parties. People say, hey, you got two parties, you can choose Republicans or Democrats. What are you talking about? Republicans or Democrats, you can choose. And it's only been in the past few years that people have finally figured out that, wait a second, both these choices kind of suck. I don't really like either one of them. And people are starting to demand another choice. And it's absolutely true. I didn't give the disclaimer earlier, so I'll do it again. You know, I'm involved deeply with the Libertarian Party of Kentucky, and so I've seen the numbers. We're growing a lot, like a whole lot, compared to Republicans and Democrats. Over the course of a year or 11 months, whatever it was, Democrats grew like 1.2%, Republicans grew 3%, we grew 40% on the Libertarian side. That's it. I mean, think about that. Republicans and Democrats together, we still grew 10 times faster than they did on the libertarian side. That's huge growth. It's huge enough that the establishment, getting back to what we talked about earlier, the establishment is scared. They don't want you to have choices outside of what they approve. And so they put artificial barriers in front of you to keep you with choice A or choice B. And they'll acknowledge, oh yeah, choice C exists, but it's not relevant. It's stupid. That's a dumb choice. You know, and they'll put barriers in front of it to prevent you from choosing choice C, which is independent, third party, whatever. Candidate wants to run for office in Kentucky as a Republican or as a Democrat, any office, any partisan office in Kentucky, they need two signatures, one, two. To run as an independent, third-party candidate, you're going to need anywhere from 25 to 5,000 signatures minimum, and really, those you're going to need 50% on top of that. So you're talking somewhere around 37, 40, whatever, to 7,500 to 8,000 signatures to run for office as an independent or third party. Barriers to entry. It's what they create. And I talked about this just barely last week because we ran out of time right at the end of the show, but in Montana, the Republican legislature pushed a bill to put to the voters the idea of changing their form of elections to a top two primary. And what that basically means is that instead of each group having their own primary, they make every candidate run in a primary, and the two that come out, no matter who they are the two that run in November. Now, in theory, this sounds fine, but in many cases, these primaries are held very early on. And having worked with third-party and independent campaigns myself, one of the key things is that they don't necessarily have the money or the machine at first that Republicans and Democrats walk into with. They have 200 years of building their machines. And make no mistake, they're effective political machines. But without the time for an alternative to build their name recognition in their case and put their platform out there, it will destroy the chance of any third party or independent to get elected to office. And in fact, that's exactly what they've done here. And they say it. The reason they did it was to keep libertarians, the Republican legislature did it, libertarians from getting. Man, I forgot to do this all out, stupid thing. So we're at the end of the show. I thank you for tuning in. Don't be controlled. Pay attention, learn, look, know what's going on. Thanks for tuning in. Tuning in another week. Next week for another edition of Living Up Vital on the Mind Your Matters Radio Network.